This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 342 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by several co-hosts. First, we have Rob Mark. He's a pilot, he's an aviation journalist, and he's publisher of the Jetwine blog.
Well, good evening from the town where it's just a few days after spring, and yet we had 6 inches of snow. But that's okay.
We're not supposed to talk about the weather, but this has been the winter where it's been impossible not to talk about the weather. So sorry to hear about the additional white stuff, Rob.
Well, you know, it could be worse. We could be talking politics, and we always know how much trouble that gets us into.
Absolutely. Well, also with us is Max Trescott. He's an author, a certified flight instructor, and a glass cockpit expert. And Max, I'm sure you have no snow where you are.
Hi, Max. Yes, here on the West Coast, Silicon Valley, our problem is that lack of clouds, lack of rain, you name it. We have become 100% VFR out here. It's kind of amazing. We just never see anything but blue sky, it seems. But we'll be asking you for water in a year or two.
Yeah, I'm sure. Also with us is our associate producer, Brian Coleman.
Hi, Max. Hi, guys. If it's okay, I actually have a really short story for you, ended in... Well, kind of involves Rob. Well, Rob's favorite airline.
Uh-oh.
So last week I was in Milwaukee, and I was connected. It was Milwaukee, O'Hare, Los Angeles. And I get finished early. I go to the airport, try and get on an earlier flight. So I do the first thing that I would do is I call the 1K desk, and they say, no, sorry, can't add you to the standby list. So I figured, I'm not going to be deterred by these people. I'm going to go up to the gate agent. And the gate agent looked at me and said, sure, not a problem. I could put you on a standby flight. So they put me on the standby flight. Unfortunately, the flight out of Milwaukee was a little bit late, so I arrived to Chicago with not much time to make the connecting gate. I run over to the connecting gate, and I'm met by the overhead display that says, boarding closed. And I go, oh, darn, that really stinks. So I walk up to the gate agent who's tapping away on the computer, and I said, and I really suspected he would say no. I said, gee, is the gate really closed? Can I get on? And he says, did you have a ticket on this flight? And I said, no, I'm flying standby, but I would really like to get on. He said, hold on. And he runs down the jetway to see if they had closed the door yet. They hadn't closed the door. The guy comes running back up and goes, tap, 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 tap. Here's your boarding pass. They opened up the gate. Wow. To let me on the plane to fly home early.
That's unusual.
So, Rob, your United Airlines pulled through for me. So I had two really positive experiences. One in Milwaukee with a gate agent to put me on the standby list. The other was the gate agent who actually opened up the door. So
fantastic.
Every once in a while, it works.
That's pretty nice. It is nice to hear. Makes up for the story we've got tonight about people doing
we're gonna hear Rob's revenge on this good news story.
Hey, I couldn't even make this stuff up, guys.
I couldn't make up
the story that they opened a closed flight for me.
Yeah. So wait a minute. Have either of you guys done a song about it yet? That's what I want to know. Dude, you remember the famous one? United Bricks guitarist?
The broken
guitar.
That
was just a riot.
Yeah. All right. All right, well, we better get to our guest this episode before we jump into the news. This week, we're joined by Peter Bunce. He's the president and CEO of the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, GAMA. how probably most of our listeners know GAMA. It's an international trade association. They represent over 85 manufacturers of general aviation, airplanes and rotorcraft, engines, avionics, components, and also related services like repair station operators and aviation training facilities and some others. Now, Pete has been president and CEO of GAMA since April 2005, and he and the GAMA staff, they travel all over the world. They engage regulators and policymakers, as well as elected officials, and promote general aviation, and also advance the interests of GAMA's international membership. Now, Pete isn't one of those professional administrators with no personal skin in the game. He's an active pilot. He has more than 6,000 hours. He's flown military fighter and training aircraft, and that means things like F-15s and A-10s. And, of course, he's flown civil piston turboprop and business jet aircraft. Pete also holds an FAA Airline Transport Certificate, also a seaplane rating. He serves on the board of directors of the Recreational Aviation Foundation, the Veterans Airlift Command, and Pete, I sent them a big check last year, as it turns out. Also,
thank you.
Oh, yeah, what a great group. But, you know, the list just keeps going on. America's Warrior Partnership, the Air Care Alliance. Pete's also a co-chair of the Next Gen Institute. He's a member of both the FAA's Next Gen Advisory Committee and the MITRE Corporation's Aviation Advisory Committee. So, Pete, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
It's good to be with you guys. Thank you.
Now, you're also a member of the Arsenal of Democracy Executive Committee, and that's planning to commemorate the 70th anniversary of Victory in Europe Day, or VE Day. And this is going to include a very large formation flyover of warbirds over Washington, D.C. We're going to talk about this a lot coming up after the news. But Pete, just really briefly, how did you come to be involved in this event?
Well, it's really kind of a fun story. Sam Graves, Congressman Sam Graves from Missouri, who a lot of you know with his active role in general aviation, came up to me at our board meeting last May after he had a little talk, and he said, "Hey, I'm an active warbird pilot as." I being Sam, he flies TBM Avengers and P-40 Warhawks and things like that on the weekends for the Texas Flying Legends. And he said, "Hey, I want to fly my TBM over the Capitol, and you know how to make those kind of things happen. See what you can do." And I said, "Oh, yeah, sir, I can just snap my fingers and get the Secret Service to do whatever I need them to do. This will be easy." And I kind of laughed. I said, "Yeah, thanks." But then the next meeting I was in that day was with Chairman McCaul, who ran the Homeland Security Committee in the House. And he said his dad was a B-17 gunner during World War II. And the following day, which was May 8th of last year, 2014, he said, "I get to go over to the World War II veterans, the memorial there, and speak to a crowd of vets on the 69th anniversary." And that's when the light came on. And I went back to Congressman Graves and I said, "Here it is. How about we fly one of everything that we can still get airborne from World War II down the Capitol Mall on the 70th anniversary of VE Day? And the reason we want to do it in May versus VJ Day in the end of the war, which is in August, is because if we've got these 90-plus-year-old vets, August heat in Washington, D.C. is pretty tough. May is generally nice. But we wanted to honor them with the whole, give them an aerial review in conjunction with the ceremony that they're having down at the memorial." Well, this thing took life very quickly, and I'm very good friends with General Daley at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, and I pitched the idea to him, and he got very enthusiastic about it, and so they became our partners as well. And then we brought in the FAA administrator, and there's, as you would imagine with the airspace in Washington, D.C., you start to bring in then the National Park Service, the Secret Service, the military, obviously the FAA controllers and everybody. And so we had to do quite a bit of work over the last 8 or 9 months to really try to nail down the route, be able to get the authorizations from the FAA, and the amazing thing is everybody has just jumped on board. Every single federal agency just says this is the right thing to do. You know, nobody's making a dime out of this. We're doing it just to pay honor to these veterans and how this nation all came together during World War II to support first the British war effort against the Nazis, and then as soon as we went to war with both Japan and Italy and Germany, then it was our war effort combined with our allies, and it's exciting. So I had the thought that we ought to run them through in historical sequence of major battles, whether they're air, land, and sea battles. And so we push the trainers through and talk about, you know, that effort, but then we start with Pearl Harbor and basically the Flying Tigers, and then proceed on to the Doolittle Raid and go to Midway, and we go all the way through to the victory and the air assault against Japan and the victory, and then we finish it up with a missing man formation, which will be led by Congressman Sam Graves in the TBM Adventure. So it's going to be really spectacular, and we have this beautiful window that's been created by the great folks that work the airspace here and along with the airlines. So we've got a 45-minute window to make this happen, with the first time over the memorial being 12:10 local on a Friday afternoon. So we just pray for great weather, and this is going to be spectacular.
It does sound like it's going to be an amazing event, and we're going to kind of dig into some of the details of what aircraft are going to be flying over and how you were able to pull all this together coming up. First, though, we've got some news, and we've got kind of quite a bit of news this week, it looks like. So I think we all better get started with that if everyone's ready. Are you guys all set for this?
Yeah.
Ready.
Ready on the West.
Well, we have this story from Jetwine. It's called Another Big United Customer Service Failure. And Rob, this is kind of a crazy story. Can you kind of give us some background on just what transpired on this United flight?
Okay. So I'm sitting at home last week, and the phone rings. And it's my brother-in-law, Sean, who is a longtime United flyer. He's an airplane geek, listens to the show, wants to learn to fly, just has never quite been able to convince his wife. But that's another story. So he really gets into all this good aviation stuff. And he said, you aren't going to believe the day I've had. And so he proceeds to tell me. And the story was so amazing about what his trip was like coming back from Vegas to Chicago O'Hare on United that I said, look, Let's just write it up the way that it happened, and we'll go from there, because it was really sad to look at a situation that the airline, who of course is at the bottom of the rank in terms of making money anyway, they just do such really dumb things, and it wouldn't have taken a whole lot of effort to make this an event that didn't, well, smell quite so badly. You know, United was in such a hurry, apparently, to get the airplane off the ground that I guess the people in the back didn't make a whole lot of difference to the event. Anyway, a lady got sick on board the airplane, and rather than deplane the people, they just tried to clean it up, and they did a really lousy job, and it was kind of a mess even when the airplane finally took off, and then somebody else got sick, and it was just... And of course, the first thing I asked when I heard the story was, don't the airlines use six sacks anymore? I thought they still had them in the pockets, but apparently not. So it was pretty bad. And again, it was really the fact that United handled it so poorly that was the story, I think.
So, I mean, other passengers, it sounds like, really would have expected United to do something more than just a superficial cleanup job, right? Because this is a kind of an unpleasant environment all of a sudden.
Well, and you know what that's like when you're around people that are vomiting. I mean, it makes you want it's very tough to keep your own lunch down. But then when another United employee posted a comment that said, look, you know what? Every station in our system has extra seat cushions, and they could have, because I guess they got sick on the seat as well as the floor. And if they'd taken an extra half an hour with, I don't know what the product was, they could have made this less obnoxious. But apparently they just really wanted to get the airplane going. And in fact, I guess if there's, I don't know if this would be irony or not, but the fact that the airplane made it back to Chicago on time.
Right. So, that was my guess.
Yeah.
They're worried about the on-time record, right?
Yeah, that's kind of what this guy said, but he's a pilot, so he kind of knows how that goes.
Hmm. Well, we see all these surveys, polls, rankings of airlines and other businesses in aviation from time to time, and we see a report in the Chicago Tribune about this customer experience rating that's come out from Temkin. And this is their airline industry 2015 annual ranking. What they do is they survey, they say, 10,000 U.S. customers, and they ask them to score the service, their own service experience with the airlines. And I guess the those on the top of the list are kind of expected, and those that you see at the bottom of the list are also kind of what you expect. And United was sort of in that bottom ranking, 7th out of 10 U.S. airlines. But the guys up front, I mean, it's kind of who you'd expect, right?
Yeah, pretty much. And
JetBlue was first, right? And then Southwest Airlines closely there, closely behind JetBlue.
Sure. But again, it's the old story. Of course, as Brian said, there are certainly going to be times when everything just runs well. But I think when you have so many people that don't like flying United for a whole host of reasons, and it's the little bitty things sometimes that you don't think would be a big deal. And it's just those little bitty details that JetBlue and Southwest are still doing pretty darn nicely. And that's why people enjoy the experience. We all know they can't control the weather. We all know airplanes break. But it's how the company handles it when, you know, it kind of goes to hell in a handbasket that really makes the difference.
Hmm. Hey, Rob, usually I'm the one who would say that United would be there at 7, 8, 9, and or 10. I was just shocked as could be that my stars aligned that day and so many things went right, and just how nice and gracious everyone was, because it certainly hasn't been that way for many years.
Yeah, it can happen.
Well, of course, you know, United did realize that you were a part of the Airplane Geek Show, so they figured they better just... not screw with Brian, so...
Yeah. Now, I'm always curious when I see these things, these rankings, to learn what the methodology is. And this one is kind of interesting. What they do is they ask customers, airline customers, to rate their satisfaction on a 7-point scale, right, where 1 is very dissatisfied and 7 is very satisfied. And then what they do is they take the percentage of consumers that give a rating of 6 or 7, the two highest rankings, and subtract the percentage that gave them a rating of 1, 2, or 3. So it's kind of like the highest minus the lowest percentages. And the results are kind of interesting. We mentioned JetBlue is ranked first, and using their methodology, they came through with 75%, Southwest Airlines 72%. Some of the others... let's see, Delta and Alaska Airlines, 69%, Virgin America, 63%, then American Airlines, 57%, United, 56%, U.S. Airways, 55%, AirTran Airways, 52%, and bringing up the bottom, anybody want to guess at 47%? Spirit Airlines.
Thought it could have been Ryanair, but this is only domestic carriers.
Yeah, that would be an interesting comparison, Ryanair versus Spirit.
Well, and we get to find that out. Remember 2 weeks ago we mentioned that Ryanair should be here in a couple of years?
That's true. And we have a chance to, an opportunity to have them included in the survey.
No, but then the board of directors came back and said, absolutely no, we never approved any of that. It, you know, it hasn't been approved. Yeah, yeah. There's a big story over how the board of directors and Mr. O'Leary apparently apologized for the miscommunication.
Hmm. All right, let's move on to an article that we saw in AIN Online. This is General Aviation Group's Air Concerns at Heli Expo. And actually, Pete was part of this. But at the Heli Expo 2015 event, some leaders from seven different GA associations met. So there were representatives besides the Helicopter Association International, AOPA was there, the EAA was there, Jack Pelton, Pete Bunce represented GAMA, also the National Association of State Aviation Officials, the National Air Transport Association, and the NBAA, and Ed Bolin. And the group kind of did, it was kind of a panel discussion. Was that the format, Pete?
Yeah. Matt Zaccaro moderated the panel.
And a number of concerns were raised, and I think you talked about the rotorcraft certification issues. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you expressed at that event.
I think that if you look at the rotorcraft world in general, it has, from the regulator standpoint, from an opportunity to be able to put safety-enhancing technology into rotorcraft, it's been in its own world for the last several decades, actually. And as we have been able to introduce new technology into general aviation fixed-wing aircraft, as well as the commercial types of aircraft, there has been a larger separation between the fixed-wing capabilities and that of rotorcraft. And we're trying to catch the rotorcraft community back up. And it's not been lack of trying by whether it's the original equipment manufacturers, the actual manufacturers of the rotorcraft, or the avionics manufacturers. The roadblock has been with regulators. And so we're trying to bring worldwide regulators, whether it's FAA, EASA, Transport Canada, along to say, okay, we've got a better way that we can provide safety-enhancing technology in all different ways to the rotorcraft community. And we're trying to bring them along in this process. And what has been encouraging is that I think the regulators understand that and recognize it and are looking to what we've been able to do with this Part 23 rulemaking through this consensus standards process, ASTM process of avionics equipage and that kind of thing to be able to go ahead and allow us to put some of these new things down. And things that I'm talking about, if you look at what we used to have problems with in fixed-wing general aviation, a controlled flight into terrain, since we have introduced glass panel technology and TAWS equipment into fixed-wing aircraft, the accident rate has decreased dramatically. We talk with the FAA. We did a very concerted safety process to develop recommendations of how we can address things like loss of control, which is now the major cause of general aviation accidents. And the result of that was, let's start getting the community familiar with AOA, start to use AOA, and also have better ability to be able to introduce envelope protection systems through autopilot systems, that kind of thing. So we have moved the safety needle there. And now the next thing we're on to with fixed wing is power plant failure. And we've got some initiatives that we want to move forward about electronic engine and monitoring instead of peanut gauges, where we can do that. Well, we can bring those same types of things to rotorcraft. And I think we have a unique opportunity in time now with the regulators being basically really restricted on resources that they have to take a risk-based approach. And by adopting a risk-based approach, that we can really increase the safety needle by having an approach that looks at where we can get the most bang for the buck, and for a company that has been doing rotorcraft for years and years and knows what they're doing, allow them to use the delegation authorities that have already been granted to them but sometimes not allowed to be exercised by the regulators, and to allow them to leverage that to be able to speed up the process of getting these new products to market. And I'm encouraged. Our partners are obviously the Helicopter Association and all the manufacturers, and I think we really have an opportunity here, and I'm excited about it.
What do you think is the sort of next step in this to make this a reality?
Well, what we're trying to do is corral all of the rotorcraft manufacturers together in a basically a study that we want to go forward with and say, what do we want this new regulatory structure to look like? In the interim, we want to be able to use some of the things that we're doing with the FAA on streamlining SDCs and the like, whether they're TSO products or the actual SDCs, to be able to make those happen faster, because the actual regulatory process of changing Part 2729 is a long process. You know, it could be 7-8 years, as we have found with the Part 23. But if we get going on it now, we can bring about change. So the first part of this process is to get all of the manufacturers together to plot out where we want to go with regulation. And it could end up being a Part 28 that gets rid of the differentiating line between 27 and 29 and looks at it more like we do in Part 23, where we're regulating all the way from very light pistons all the way up to jets, and start to say, okay, this is a spectrum of products, and we look at the different complexities there and look at different methods of compliance. So there is a lot of opportunity for positive change.
And Pete, another topic that came out at this event was ADS-B, but not this time about, you know, when is it coming, but this was about privacy protection under ADS-B. What's the issue there?
Well, if you look at what all the associations led by NBA did when the previous transportation secretary wanted to strip away the protections for the BAR program, which basically allows you as an operator to sign up and say, I don't want my information shared with the general public. We were able, through legislation, to be able to get that back reinstated. So if you want to have an opportunity to opt out, you can do that through the different FAA tracking systems. But with ADS-B, as you're aware, once you have that installed, every tail number has a unique identifier that can be tied to that tail number, and basically anybody with a low-cost type of receiver will be able to track airplanes all over. And if you look at the privacy aspect and the security aspect for that, that becomes problematic. So we're trying to work some issues in multiple fronts, because it's not just ADS-B, so there's some other systems in there that we want to be able to work with, that if an individual wants to be able, for security reasons or corporate reasons, not to know where their aircraft are going, that we have a way to be able to allow them that privacy. So it's a challenge, and we're working with it. And NBA, again, this is the way we work issues with all of the GA associations is, you know, if it's a certain issue that rests very closely into that association's wheelhouse, the other associations line up on the wing, and like GAMA would lead a certification issue, NBA is leading this privacy issue. HAI right now is leading an issue. We just found out there was a congressman that introduced a bill the other day that wanted to strip the GI Bill benefits for flight training out. So HAI made us aware, all the associations aware of that, and we all got together and said, Matt, why don't you lead the response to that? We'll all join on your wing and get some information to General Caucus about how damaging this would be. So that's how we work issues. And it's great, because we communicate very frequently with each other to take on the many issues that hit us in D.C. and in Europe and in Canada and Brazil.
Yeah, and I've got to believe that all the organizations combined represent a significant amount of, well, power, but also, you know, knowledge and experience to address these kinds of issues in an effective way. Has it always been that way, or is this something relatively recent?
Well, I have seen it growing more strong. I think where we probably really turn the corner on the GA associations working together very tightly is when the airlines went after us several years ago with the Aunt Edna campaign and the trying to go after us for user fees and everything. So that brought us all close together, and we found how effective we can be by mobilizing each other's communities. So we all have strength. You know, obviously AOPA and EAA as large membership associations can bring a lot of power to bear on general aviators. And then you take GAMA, which are major employers of a tremendous number of great wage-earning jobs in the manufacturing sector. We bring those jobs to bear and those large companies together. And, of course, NBA can mobilize companies that are outside of aviation through their flight departments and that. And so you've got each of the associations being able to do that. Greg Principato, that represents the airports around the country, and with NASAO, can bring together the flight aviation officials from each one of the states. So we all work cooperatively on these issues, and that strength is formidable. And you know, a lot of people say, okay, well, what initiatives have you brought forward? And we each bring forward a lot of issues during FAA reauthorization, but a lot of times we just play very effective defense together. And a lot of times success in Washington is when bad things don't happen to your industry as much as when good things happen, you know. And we've had a lot of instances where bad things have come down, and we've been able to fend those off by working cooperatively together.
All right. Well, we want to touch on this forecast that's come out from the FAA. This is a forecast for fiscal years 2015 to 2035, and it covers a lot of territory, but it does have some things to say about general aviation. And they talk about fleet increases growing at an average of 0.4% a year, which sounds kind of small. But when you break that out, they forecast fixed wing turbine aircraft to grow at 2.2% per year, fixed wing piston aircraft to decline at a rate of 0.6% per year, and rotorcraft to grow at a rate of 2.5% per year. So rotorcraft and turbine aircraft growth kind of pacing that. Pete, is that kind of in line with your expectations?
Well, I'm going to be very blunt here. I don't even pay attention to the FAA projections because if you recall, several years ago, VLJs were going to blacken the skies and yes, everything. So I absolutely don't even pay attention to them because I don't think anybody in their right mind can predict out that far. And I think it's far more accurate to look at what the manufacturers are looking toward, and they never predict out that far. We do, you know, 5-year projections and that. And I think that we're going to see growth in all of the different segments. But of course, we have an aging fleet out there. So we're going to have, as more, especially in the light end of general aviation, more pilots retiring due to age and more older aircraft. The average age of the general aviation fixed wing piston out there is over 40 years old. And you just physically can't keep all that metal flying with metal fatigue forever unless you have an infinite amount of resources to be able to be spending on those aircraft. So naturally we're going to have some degradation in the piston numbers, but I think that'll be also accelerated by the fact that we're going to have new power plant technology out there. You know, what we're able to do with electric or hybrid propulsion. And then you look at what the fleet will actually look like. And if you really think about it, what are unmanned aerial vehicles or remotely piloted aircraft, whatever we want to call them, drones, what are those? Those are part of general aviation. They will be when we get them into the system, because we define general aviation as everything that's not scheduled airlines or military. And so when you talk about the fleet and the airspace or congestion in the airspace or flight activity, all of a sudden we have those aircraft that are going to be entering the system. So what this world is going to look like by 2020, let alone 2035, is really, you know, my crystal ball or Ouija board is no better than anybody else's. So yeah. I'm sorry to be negative on.
No, I think that's that, realistic.
And Max, you were talking about the units. The same forecast talks about the number of hours that are going to be flown. Number of hours has declined probably every year for at least the last 5+ years. And yet this shows a total reversal. Total hours flown is going to jump from 23 million this year to 30.6 million in 2035. So I'm not sure what caused the inflection point, but certainly it's at odds with what I think we've seen the last few years.
And if you look at the, commercial side, who could have ever predicted the type of consolidations that we have seen in the last few years? And, you know, now we're running aircraft at very high load factors. You know, you very seldom find an aircraft that has open seats, where if you remember back 5-6 years ago, that was the norm. And now that doesn't happen. So the airlines have gotten smarter about how they're doing business, and there's been a contraction there. I don't think anybody predicted that.
Well, one thing that people try to forecast, of course, is what's going to happen in China, because some people feel that China represents an enormous opportunity for general aviation in particular. We see an article in China News where China has apparently some 2,800 counties, but only 78 are served by general aviation at the present time. And what the Chinese are looking at is, what if all 2,800 counties had a general aviation airport under the five-year plan? The current five-year plan is the 13th five-year plan from 2016 to 2020. And they look at the economic value that would result from that. Pete, are the general aviation companies watching China? Do they see opportunity in that country?
Well, China is a very complex country, and we're watching it so closely that, as all of you are aware, several of our longstanding U.S. companies are Chinese-owned. You look at Cirrus, Continental Motor Group, Mooney, Enstrom, they're all Chinese-owned. So there is obviously a very strong desire on the part of Chinese entrepreneurs and governmental entities to be able to buy up general aviation companies and invest that with them, to with the anticipation that at some point they will be able to not only bring production to China, but to grow it, because they know there's going to be intense domestic demand. Now, with that said, we in the manufacturing world have been waiting for the Chinese market to break open for many years now. And the governor on that, or the hurdles out there, is really the People's Liberation Army, which runs the Air Force and runs their airspace, which is all the time trying to be able to keep a lid, for lack of a better term, on the growth of general aviation. But I think it's very encouraging if you look at what the Chinese government wants to do now, which is start to look at their economy as developing within their different provinces and their cities, to open up more such things as the airborne side of freight hauling, FedEx or UPS, DHL type of format between their cities, which bodes very well for general aviation, turboprop and jet. And of course, if you look at all new construction that I have witnessed in their big cities, that hospitals are putting heliports in because they definitely know they have to have better medical evac and disaster response. So I'm very encouraged by that. Right now, when you look at the limitation of the airspace up to 3,000, there's arguments as to what actually is the top of the airspace, whether it's 3,000 meters or a little bit beyond that. But still, that lends itself to very much the light end of general aviation and training, but they haven't connected a lot of these cities together so that you can go cross country over there. So there are a lot of things that are developing on the light end. On the business end, if you recall, a few years ago after the recession, business aviation, that was the big play, was China, and there was a big rapid number of purchases over there. But the austerity programs of the new government, which has clamped down on government officials, travel, among other things, has really cooled that market somewhat. So it's you know, there are some areas that are very rosy, some areas that are less promising than there were a few years ago. But I think it is unquestionable that the Chinese intend, in a big country like theirs, to be able to use general aviation to increase their economic output and to tie cities together. And so when it comes, it's going to come big. And it's just our job to keep working with the regulators to try to make it happen sooner.
And it's very, very comparable to the U.S. in a couple of different ways. So 2,800 counties sounds like a lot. We have got about 3,000 here in the U.S., and the landmass of the U.S. and China is almost identical. So it's pretty easy to imagine that, yeah, if general aviation takes off like it has in the U.S., you know, 2,800 airports, totally appropriate.
Absolutely. If you look at their mountainous terrain and you know, their major population is on the eastern seaboard, but they've got a vast country that they've got to connect together, much easier to do it through the air than it is to put rail or roads everywhere. So there, if you look at the explosive growth of commercial aviation throughout that vast country, it's, you know, it's different development than ours. Commercial's going first, but I think that general aviation is absolutely, they've got to train pilots. I just got word today that that it looks like the government will approve some of their first amateur-built aircraft over there, which is very encouraging, because whenever we see people have an ability to build aircraft on their own like that, that's just a great bellwether to other parts of general aviation. So I'm excited.
My experience with business in China has been that the Chinese like to enter into joint venture arrangements with foreign companies rather than just be pure Chinese consumers. So, I mean, that has some interesting implications for general aviation and other aviation companies that have an eye towards conducting business in China. So, Pete, are those kinds of relationships you know, forming up, joint ventures and sort of those kinds of things, or do the manufacturers outside of China look more to just simply sell product into China?
Well, each manufacturer is different, and a lot of aviation manufacturers have had joint ventures for years. Some have been successful, some not. I think that as we learn more about how China does business, people walk into these with more savvy. I think some of the recent joint ventures, recognizing the great engineering capability that China has now, that they will go into a joint venture and put each other's intellectual property at risk, which heretofore has been a concern and still is to many companies over there, that intellectual property is looked at differently than our traditional way of looking at it in the U.S. And so companies have to really be careful on how they protect that. But if you join in a venture that has both responsible for developing intellectual property and put both at risk, you may have a formula to be able to make them work. So again, it's all over the map as to how people want to do business over there. But again, you would expect we would expect, as a new industry comes to the U.S., that we would want to have a piece of the development of that industry from manufacturing base. You can't expect the Chinese to do differently. Sure. So it only makes sense.
All right. Okay, Max T, we talked about ADS-B a little bit earlier, and you've found something here about ADS-B prices.
Yeah, so you know, just to back up, you know, the big picture obviously is that by January 1, 2020, all aircraft have to be equipped with ADS-B out. And to date, about the lowest price I've seen, you know, for any of the mass marketed solutions has been around $4,500, which obviously that's peanuts to an airline. It's big bucks to you know, a Cessna 150 or, you know, a small aircraft. Free Flight Systems announced a program they called Equip It 2020, in which they're going to be offering ADS-B out systems for less than $2,000, which big drop and probably exactly what's needed to kickstart this. The adoption rate's been a little slow. If you look at the number of airplanes that have been equipped, it's over 10,000, but you figure there's still probably 200,000 to be equipped over the next, 4 years or so. And so I think this really gives, I think, people incentive to start making that conversion now. What's interesting is they've also offered a low-cost option that includes ADS-B in as well. Of course, that's the really valuable service, if you will, to a small aircraft. ADS-B out, most GAA operators would say, hey, it doesn't really benefit them. It benefits perhaps the FAA. But when you get ADS-B in, then you can finally see some benefit because then you can actually see the other aircraft around you. And that system, they said, will sell for about $3,700. Now, one way they're able to keep that so cheap is the output device is going to be your mobile device. So, in other words, you'd be looking at your iPad, for example, to see the traffic. But I think that's a great alternative because so many pilots are carrying an iPad anyway, and it really provides a nice low entry point, finally, which is what I think people have been looking for.
Pete, do you think this will cause it to accelerate the adoption rate?
Well, I think we need to put everything in a little bit of perspective here in that, you know, there have been a lot of naysayers out there toward ADS-B, and we, as manufacturers, have always said, let the market work. And we're witnessing right now the marketplace in action, which is what our country is all about. Competition is a good thing. And there are, whether you're talking FreeFlight, Aspen, L3, Garmin, every one of our avionics manufacturers is out there now with the product. We'll have another announcement with a major avionics manufacturer coming up right before the AEA convention in a couple weeks in Dallas. That will, again, be very – it'll make the Piston Aviation very happy. And we can't separate the two because if you think about it, ADS-B out is the enabler for ADS-B in. So if you really, to me, one of the largest benefits of ADS-B in is that I can see other traffic. And when you think about the air-to-air function of that in a pattern, especially congested pattern, and how many mid-airs we have had where you didn't have situational awareness of all the aircraft, whereas you're trying to build this mind's eye view from all the radio calls, now all of a sudden you're able to look down and know where that aircraft is that you might be on a collision vector with. That is a true safety enhancer, but it only works if everybody's squitting out ADS-B out so that you can see it with whatever your portable device or whatever device, if it's in your cockpit panel-mounted display, that you can see it. So they are definitely connected. I have always had arguments with people that have said, I don't get any benefit from ADS-B out because when you tie it all together, remember that the federal government spent millions upon millions of dollars to enable the ADS-B in function through the pipe that we call UAT and not the 1090 frequency, because we wanted in general aviation to be able to see free weather, to be able to see traffic. And now that the FAA has deployed all of the ground stations, if you take the Rockies and everything eastward, above 1,500 feet, you can get picked up anywhere. You have that ADS-B capability of being able to have in IMC conditions to be able to have a pickup from ATC services, but you still have that air-to-air function below that. Now think about the introduction of UASs into the system and the importance that we will have to be able to see these machines electronically when somebody loses one, which will happen often even with line-of-sight operations, my prediction, and that we aren't going to be able to see these small birds with our eyes. And you know what this will do to an aircraft. You think a bird strike is bad, and we test engines for running birds through them. We don't test engines running pieces of plastic and metal up to 55 pounds. So we've got to be able to have a capability. So this is a big deal, and I'm very happy that that the price is now, I think, much more attractive to our operator groups. AOPA and EAA seem happy that, again, the marketplace worked. I think you'll see some editorials coming out in the near future. I don't know if you read Mac McClellan's article recently from EAA that really gave a good history of where they're coming from and how the FAA actually followed through and doing what they said they would do. And I think you'll see the same thing out of AOPA. So now the challenge is to get everybody to start thinking about equipping, because if everyone waits, like we did with our VSM, more in the business aviation arena, but people waited till the mandate was almost upon them, and then we didn't have the industrial capacity. And what happens when demand goes up? price goes up. So it makes sense to start thinking about equipping now while the lines are still not real long at the installation centers, and the price won't go up because demand is too high.
Again, we're speaking with Pete Bunce, the president and CEO of GAMA, the General Aviation Manufacturers Association. Pete, at the beginning of the show, we talked a little bit about the Arsenal of Democracy flyover. Just what kind of aircraft do we expect to see? And this is going to be, what, this is May 8th, I believe?
May 8th, Friday, May 8th, which is the 70th anniversary of victory in Europe. And so if you look at the progression of aircraft, we've got the Elbirds, we've got the Stearman training aircraft, and T-6 is coming over in the first wave, and then after that we start the historical progression. So we'll have P-40s commemorating Pearl Harbor and the Flying Tigers, and then move on to B-25s. We have a formation of B-24s with their Red Tail escorts commemorating the Tuskegee Airmen. We've got a midway formation that has a Dauntless in it, as well as Wildcats. Let's see, we go I mentioned the Ploesti raid. We have obviously our Mustangs. We've got P-47s, P-38s, B-17s. Let's see, A-26s, Catalina, and then of course the Bearcat, Hellcat, and the TBM, and we finish this all off with we've got obviously Corsairs commemorating Iwo Jima. I think we've got a P-39 commemorating Guadalcanal. That's along with the Wildcat. And so each one of these battles we try to represent with the aircraft that fought in that battle. And then we finish with Fifi showing the air assault on Japan for the historical progression. And then we do the missing man formation of combined fighters from the Army Air Corps, the Navy, and the Marines.
Wow. Now, I've got to believe these aircraft are coming from all over the United States.
Absolutely. And the Commemorative Air Force is our partners along with the International Council of Air Shows, and we have our controllers with us. So NATCA has been a great partner with us, and we're still looking for more sponsorships out there. The more sponsorships we have, the more aircraft we can bring to Washington. So we're trying to fly more than one of everything. We're trying to build the formations as large as possible. But how many we have? These airplanes amazingly drink a lot of oil in addition to a lot of avgas. So it is not a cheap production to put on. So if there's anybody out there, we have crowdsourcing available for funds. If you've got a relative or you just want to be patriotic and throw some money toward the cause, what's really exciting to me is that we're talking with the World War II Monuments folks, and they are getting such a huge, huge response of people wanting to bring in their veterans. And these are not just World War II veterans. We've got Korean War veterans, Vietnam veterans. People are bringing their fathers, mothers in that served during that period of time. And our goal is to just really point out how this nation came together with the war we have against ISIS now and everything going on. It's a good time to remind ourselves of what this nation could really do when we all pull together. And we hope to be able to have one really good aerial review for these vets. And this may be one of the last opportunities. There is a wonderful project going on to commemorate the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor that will go on out in Hawaii in 16 and December 16, which will be wonderful. But these great men and women are not getting any younger.
Yeah, for sure. Are there some prime spots where this can be observed?
Well, the route is fantastic. And again, through the cooperation of the Secret Service, the FAA, the National Park Service, and the interagency group that we have just some superstars that have been J.J. Johnson. I'm going to mention him by name because he's been kind of corralling. He works for the FAA, but he's been putting this all together for us and getting this interagency group to really push to help us there. We're going to come down the Potomac River from the Legion Bridge, which those of you familiar with the Washington Beltway is up on the north end of town, and they'll come down the Potomac just like they would a river arrival if you were flying into National Airport, and then they will come feet dry right at the Lincoln Memorial and pick up Independence Avenue. So they'll come right down Independence Avenue over the memorial and just slightly to the south so that we have a good viewing angle. But you've really, with the trees and everything and the way the memorial's laid out, the veterans looking from the memorial down toward the Lincoln will get a good shot of these aircraft coming in. We have the best narrator in the business with us. We got the best air boss in the business doing this, and then it'll go right over the FAA building and the National Air and Space Museum, and then take a slight right turn over by the Capitol, and then head back out feet wet onto the Potomac. So right down Independence Avenue for 40 plus minutes will just be fantastic. And the night before, we're doing a huge gala at the Air and Space Museum where we have a lot of our famous veterans together. We're trying to get some from each one of the services. We got it, Colonel McGee, Tuskegee Airmen, Bob Hoover, Bud Anderson, and a bunch of other luminaries, and David Hartman, those of you that remember Good Morning America several years back. Right. He's one of the greatest interviewers around. He just loves aviation. He's going to moderate our panel for us, and we've got sponsorships available for tables for that. So it's really going to be one heck of a great time, and we're going to station all of the fighters and up to the twin engine bombers down at Culpeper. We've got a great organization down there led by Mike Dale, who are our hosts there for a lot of aircraft activity. And then the four engine bombers will be stationed out of Manassas. So it's we've got a lot of the communities in the local Washington, D.C. area helping out with this as well.
Boy, it's so nice to see something or hear about something where everybody seems to be, you know, coming together on a topic rather than being, you know, divisive about it. One thing that that I've been wondering about is the airspace over Washington. That's controlled airspace. So what kind of challenges did you encounter in trying to bring this off in that kind of an environment?
Well, that's what we thought would be the absolute toughest challenge, because obviously this airspace has become the most restricted in the country for civil airspace since 9/11. But working with the Secret Service and the FAA and those other agencies that I talked about, the great thing is each one of the folks that lead those agencies and their staffs are as patriotic as all of us are, and they want to see this happen. So they have really worked together with us in a very cooperative fashion, saying, let's make this happen. This is historic. And so I cannot say enough good things about the cooperation that we've had with our federal agency partners to try to pull this thing off. It's really overwhelmed all of us that there was this can-do attitude from day one from almost everybody that just said, let's figure out how to make this happen. And that was no small task. I mean, we had to give noise data to the National Park Service about vibration of the Washington Monument because, as you know, the earthquake here a few years ago, there was just a big reconstruction program to shore it up, and everybody wanted to be assured that the vibrations from the engines wouldn't affect the monument. So we had to go through that. But once the answers were given and we work with these agencies, I have just been so pleased at the cooperation we've received.
Just amazing. There's a website where folks can learn more about this event, right?
Arsenal Democracy. Yes. And just Google that and you can get on the website and you can learn more. And it's something that keeps building to a crescendo, and we have, I think, the Today Show is going to cover it live in the morning during their morning shows, and hopefully one of the networks will pick it up. We're going to try to have several agencies podcast the narration, so those that paid attention when the space shuttle came over several years ago when it was being delivered to the Udvar-Hazy facility out of Dulles, may recall that virtually the whole city of Washington came out to the mall to watch this. It was fascinating to be standing there and just see people pouring out of their office buildings to come down to the mall and watch this. And this is even going to be more up close and personal than that, as they had to fly around and ring P-56, the restricted area, where we're right on the edge of it down Independence Avenue. So if we can pull this off and have this podcast so people can actually listen to it on their mobile devices, the narration, that'll just add to the excitement.
Cool. Maxie, do you have a question?
Yes, I was just curious, what kind of altitude are they going to be flying over the downtown at?
Well, legally, 1,000 feet. So I'd love for us to be able to get down lower than that. But the FAA has been very cooperative with us in giving us our approvals and everything and looking at these different aircraft. So you don't look a gift horse in the mouth. So that's, I mean, you know, to me, the lower would be better. But 1,000 feet is where we've been approved to. So that's what we'll do.
And you still have to avoid the White House, I presume?
Yeah, Independence Avenue, as you know, runs down on the south. So you have Constitution, which runs basically on the south side of the ellipse area by the White House, and then you have the mall, and then there's Independence Avenue on the other side. So these aircraft will come down Independence Avenue, and we actually have couple of platforms, both a helicopter and a fixed-wing aircraft that have space-stabilized cameras in that, so we'll be able to have some great camera angles, airborne angles of the aircraft coming in for the feeds to the different television networks and internet networks that want to cover it as well.
Any thought about having some organization create a documentary or video this in some way, or just leaving that up to the news organizations?
No, we actually have a company that's working. They're actually talking with different networks to be able to see who would be interested in this documentary here, because we obviously want to collect all the archive. We have a media day that's going to go on at both Culpeper and Manassas on the Thursday prior, where we're going to have a lot of media out there to be able to see the formations, because although we're not going to practice coming right down the mall route, we've got a lot of video footage. We ran the practice run last week, and it went over fantastic and got great video. We have all the formations practicing together, so it's going to be a big day of flying both on Wednesday and Thursday.
That's great. And then I understand on Saturday, the 9th of May, that some of the planes will be over at the Udvar-Hazy Center adjacent to Dulles Airport.
That's correct. And we wanted an opportunity for the public, after they see this great event, to be able to go out there and get up and close and personal to a lot of these aircraft. So we've had many of our aircraft that are coming in from all over the country volunteer to go over there to the Udvar-Hazy Center. And we have a sponsor that's picking up the fuel for that event to be able to facilitate that. And so we've had a lot of great Americans that have just stood up, and not only Americans, some of our allies, two companies that belong to our allies, and have stepped up and said, I want to do an in-kind contribution for this portion or that portion. Not enough yet to do as many aircraft as we'd be able to do if we had all the resources, but hopefully that money will come in.
That's great. Well, Pete, we want to thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with us this episode, talking about the Arsenal of Democracy flyover and all the other things that Gamma is doing. This is your participation in this in the flyover is separate from your role in Gamma, I assume.
Well, it's separate to some extent, but I think that it goes along with exactly what we're about as manufacturers. You know, I'm reading a book now called Freedom's Forge, and it just talks about how we geared up for the war effort and how in a very short time this country just absolutely changed its entire industrial processes on the automotive model to be able to make this all happen and to win the war with the machines that we were able to produce. And it's a fascinating story, and that's what our manufacturers are all about. So all of our Gamma members were very enthusiastic about saying, yes, go forward and put some staff effort into making this happen.
Great. All right. You can find the Arsenal of Democracy flyover webpage at www.flyover.org. We invite all of you to check that out. And if you're going to be in the Washington area, Washington, D.C. area, or can arrange to be there May 8th this year, we'd really encourage you to do that. And Pete, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yep, May 8th, 2015, so just in about 6 weeks, and that we're going to have a great show. And again, anybody that would like to participate and anybody that would like to help contribute to make it happen, we'd appreciate it.
That's great.
Thanks a lot.
And we thought that the shuttle going over was going to be a big deal.
Yeah, this is going to be just something amazing to see. Yeah, this is this makes Washington a sort of a must-do destination in early May.
Yeah, he didn't mention anything about needing the official podcasters for this event.
No.
I did hear he mention something about somebody podcasting live or something.
You didn't hear him say the word geeks as he said that, though, did you?
No, but we'll have an opportunity maybe to make some arrangements there.
Yeah, no, it sounds like if one were going to go to Washington this year, that sounds like the day to be there.
All right, I see we have a shout-out, the Mojave Experimental Fly-In. That's coming up in April, I believe. Is that right, Max?
Yeah, I just read about this today. It's the fourth time they've done this down at Mojave, and I was kind of I guess it's kind of started small and gotten bigger. I hadn't heard about these before, but it's a 2-day event, and of course Mojave is just a hotbed for aircraft innovation. I think everybody probably knows that. You know, that's where the Rutan brothers have been working all the years to make fabulous aircraft. And there's a very, very large group of experimental aircraft builders there, not all necessarily associated with Scaled Composites, the Rutan company. Hmm. But they are gearing up for an event April 17th and 18th, in which they're going to invite pilots to fly in or drive in and spend the weekend with them. They're going to be doing a lot of flying and demonstrating and showing off of aircraft that they've built. They're trying to make it a fun event, complete with pizza and movies, poker run and flower bombing type events, indoor radio control flying competition. And what's really kind of fun, I think, for our Geeks listeners is there is a trailer for a movie that they are working on about this, which is just went up online a few days ago, I guess. So I'm guessing in our show notes, they can go ahead and click on that and get a feel for exactly what this event's going to look like.
All right. Very good. Thanks. All right, let's move on to some listener mail. We have a voicemail came in from our faithful listener, Stephen Tornblum. And this is concerning, Airline Pilot Guy, that podcast, and his report of the recent LaGuardia runway excursion. So here's Stephen.
Hey, guys, it's Stephen out here in sunny and warm Southern California. I was just listening to episode, I believe it's 340 with the propeller guy, and you guys had briefly discussed about the Delta MD-88 that went off the runway at LaGuardia, and I wanted to give a suggestion if anybody wanted further or a little more detailed information on that incident. I also listened to another podcast called the Airline Pilot Guy, run by Captain Jeff Nielsen. He has given a few shout outs to you guys, as of course you guys are a very good podcast. And but he goes into extreme depth in episode 158. I think it's the most recent or the second most recent episode. He has ATC recordings of the incident. He does almost like a play-by-play and from a captain or a pilot's perspective of what could have gone wrong or, you know, what he would or would not do based on the weather conditions. And, I mean, everything he goes over in detail. And his episodes, I think, are like 2 to 3 hours long on average. And he probably spends, my guess is, anywhere from like 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes just on this section. And it's really, really interesting. So I just wanted to let you guys know, for any listeners, who want more information, check out airlinepilotguide.com. It's episode 158. And if you guys haven't heard it, I recommend you guys, like Rob and Mac especially, go over and listen. Really, really well done by him. That's all. I enjoyed the episode. Very fascinating about propellers. I learned a few things. I had no idea that they could be that complicated. Kind of makes me look at my A320s on the ramp a little differently. Anyway, that's about it. I will talk to you later and look forward to the next episode. Cheers.
All right. Thanks, Stephen. Yeah, Airline Pilot Guy is a fantastic podcast. In fact, Jeff has been on this show, I think, just once. Airline Pilot Guy is the one podcast that's most listened to by our listeners. At least that's what came out of our listener survey from last year. A very good one. And you can find that at airlinepilotguy.com. And we'll put a link to episode 158 right in the show notes, so you can just check that out there if you want to get to that episode.
So let me ask you, has the Airline Pilot Guy ever had us on his show?
And he has not had
I think we should crash his show next week.
Yeah, that's a good possibility. Show up.
Yeah. I don't know where he records it from, but we could all just
Well, see, that's the thing, because
and say, "Hey, it's us."
Because he's an active airline pilot. He records in the hotel rooms where he's overnighting or whatever. So he doesn't have just one place. He's recording all over the country.
So he doesn't have that big, large studio like we have here, then, huh?
No, he has the small, compact, mobile studio. But from his audio quality, you would never know that it wasn't done in a full studio. Really, really high production values.
Hopefully, we're not giving away too many inside secrets here.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And let's see, we got an email from Bill. He says he's planning to fly from Europe to Washington in a few months. And he says, I plan to spend 2 days in total at the Air and Space Museum's two sites. So that would be the National Air and Space Museum downtown in Washington and the Uverhazy Center out at Dulles. And he says, can you recommend research material that would max my experience? He says he listens to Airplane Geeks and to also the UAV Digest, and he thanks us for those wonderful shows. So, well, I don't know when Bill is coming to Washington, but, if it's around May 8th, I think or close enough to that, we know of a flyover that he may want to watch. As for research material, I don't know. I asked David, but I haven't heard back from him to see if he's got any suggestions. The website for the Air and Space Museum is airandspace.si.edu, and there's some lots of material there about the exhibits and the things that you can see at the two museums. Maybe we'll hear from David on other tips for being prepared for that experience, or maybe any of our listeners have some suggestions for Bill as well. Just send those to us. And then we received a couple of emails from some folks talking about the pilot shortage. And we've mentioned in the past that we're kind of noodling an idea where maybe we have some kind of a forum or listener forum or some kind of a way that we can get some people together who are interested and passionate about this topic and kind of talk through some of the views, the ideas, the thoughts on that. And Richard is one of the folks who sent us an email on that topic. He brings out the point that, another way to get into aviation is via the military. And that's what he did. And he has some advice and some thoughts on that. But I think that this idea of a forum, and that's also something that another listener, Rodney, brought up in an email to us, is something that we're gonna try to figure out a way to put together. I think it might be interesting. We could, guys, we could feature our listeners speaking to this issue rather than us. What do you think?
No.
you want to hear yourself talk, Rob. Is that it?
Well, yeah. I mean, and you know why? you're supposed to say, why, Rob?
Why is that, Rob?
Yeah, why, Rob?
Because I'm self-aware. I am so aware of myself that I can do all this by myself, and I don't need no input. We don't need no listener comments. No, actually, I think that's an interesting idea. It's just the technology. How would we make that work?
Yeah, we could. There's a couple of options. One is we could do it like we do this show with all of us and our guests and just have a bunch of people on Skype. Another, a little bit maybe more interesting way to do it is something called is a Google Hangout. And they have something called Google Hangouts on Air. And if we go that route, what that would let us do is bring in a number of people who could also do video. So it would be a video cast as well as an audio cast. But not only that, is you'd have a live chat room, and others would have an opportunity to, well, listen and watch as this panel was being conducted. And it would be much more interactive. And then, of course, the whole thing is recorded, and you can, you know, view the video afterwards on YouTube or listen to the audio on, you know, on the podcast. So that's kind of attractive. Maybe if we have a listener who has a lot of really good technical experience with Google Hangouts on Air, maybe someone who could kind of act as our producer for that forum, that might be a good way to pull this off. So if any of you out there feel inclined and qualified to step into with that role, let us know. Write us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com.
This would be great.
Like, this would need a little testing before we go to press.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this would not be something that we would try for the first time live. Yeah, we want to try some dry runs with this for sure.
But I think it's very exciting that finally we're going to get this problem resolved once and for all.
Yeah. Well, the quality of the listener feedback that we've received from the two guys I mentioned and, you know, and some others has just been really high. I mean, we really have some informed and interesting listeners. And I think this could be kind of a really instructive a forum. And who knows if it would end up in consensus or, you know, a diversion of views. But in any way, or in any case, I think it'd be pretty interesting and instructive. So,
you know, it'd be fun to see if we can get some industry experts. And I'm thinking, for example, what if we could get a regional airline CEO or someone like that? That, I think, would be truly awesome.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, so looking for volunteers. And anybody else who, you know, is interested in maybe participating in this, reach out to us, and we'd appreciate that. All right, well, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. You've been listening to episode 342. Find us at airplanegeeks.com and all the usual social media places. Just look for Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook, Google+. And we're also on Stitcher.com and TuneIn Radio. As I mentioned, if you want to write us, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Find us at airplanegeeks.com, or you can go directly to this episode's show notes at airplanegeeks.com/342. We want to thank our guest. This episode was Peter Bunce, President and CEO of the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, GAMA. Their website is gamma.aero, A-E-R-O. Be sure to take a look at that website. And the Arsenal of Democracy flyover site, again, is www.flyover.org. Take a look at that. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening.
Sound of Freedom going over my house.
Yeah, I was going to say, at first I didn't know what that was, but then it dawned on me.
So join us again next week on the Airplane Geeks podcast as we talk aviation. I did it backwards. Done.
And that's a wrap.
And that's a wrap. A wrap, a wrap.
You're making me hungry. I could use a wrap right now. That would be good.
Oh, I was actually thinking we need an Airplane Geeks wrap, you know.
Well, let's talk to Brother Love. Maybe they can do one for us.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah. I wonder if
my my daughter's boyfriend does some of that stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
He asked me the other day, so do you like that? And I went, yeah.
And sure. Then you played him some Frank Sinatra and said, hey, do you like that?